Koopas. Everybody knows it's true. If you come for chalupas, I've got some stuff for you. Oh yeah. All right, sorry. Hey, kids, this is Rish Outfield, and you are listening to Yawn, Old with an E, Rish Outcast. This is another episode on my way to go visit Big. I have not gone to visit that guy in a month. And I wish I could say that I had not had opportunity to record a podcast in all that time, but I think I've probably done three. So this is going to be one of those self-serving episodes where I talk about something you may buy. And you were there at the inception of this. In early 2016, I thought about writing a story about a horror movie that got made years ago, and there was a man who acted in the horror movie, and he never acted again, and he went off and lived his life and forgot about it. And then years later, in the 21st century, he discovers that this horror movie has a cult following and that people love it. And in fact, people are obsessed with it. I believe it was a Rish Outcast where I pitched that idea or talked about that idea. Maybe not, but I'm fairly sure that that's what it was. And gosh, if I had to guess, I'd say that was January 2016. And here we are, not all that long later, and that story is available to purchase. It is out there as both a text version and an audiobook version performed by me, and it's called Newfound Fame. And I have either in an episode that has aired before this or more likely an episode that will air after this, talked about the title Newfound Fame. I recognize that that's not going to sell a lot of copies. But I think that the premise is really solid. Basically, Ernst Hillerman is an old man. I never say how old he is exactly, but he's in his 70s. He's retired. He lives out somewhere in one of the Carolinas. I believe it's South Carolina. Sort of in a cabin or, you know, a rustic old house with woods all around, and he's by himself. He never married, he never had any kids, and there's a knock at his door, and it's a man who is there to ask him if he will come to Salt Lake City, Utah, for a horror film convention, and if he will do a panel and a signing, remembering the Brown Depths, which I believe was the name of his horror movie in 1987, the horror movie that he acted in. And he played the creature from the Brown Depths, the monster from the Brown Depths. Ernst doesn't believe it at first that there's a cult following built up around this movie, because it's one of those movies that came out and it never went anywhere. Nobody went to it in the movie theater. It just disappeared after a couple of weeks, and it slipped through the cracks, wasn't even released on VHS, which was a big, big deal in 1987. Well, 88, you know, when that would have come out. And people haven't mentioned it to him for so long. It's probably been 20 years since anybody mentioned that movie to him. And yet, Anton Moss, the man who comes to his door, convinces him to come on out. You know, we'll pay you per diem, I don't know what a per diem is, because I've never had one, but we'll pay you an appearance fee and you can charge for autographs. And believe me, there are people who would love to hear you talk, love to get a picture with you, love to meet you. And so he goes out to Salt Lake. You may ask, well, why did I do it in Salt Lake? And I just thought, well, where is the least likely place that you would have a horror film convention. And just seemed like Salt Lake is a perfect... Wait, what's the opposite of perfect? It's an imperfect place for that kind of convention. It just amused me, the idea of going there because of, you know, what Salt Lake represents. Anyway, so he flies out there. They fly him out, Ernst, to go to this convention, and discovers that, yes, there's a huge cult following built up around the movie that he was part of. But what he doesn't find out until somebody brings it up at the convention is that there was a curse of the Brown Depths. That's what they call it. A curse on this production. Everybody who was involved in the making of the movie, the director, the producer, the actors, the makeup person, the dolly grip, although, no, I never said the dolly grip, but all these people are gone. They're either dead or they disappeared off the face of the earth, leading people to believe that there is a curse on the production. And Ernst never heard of this because he was off the radar. He was off living in a cabin. In fact, he appeared uncredited in the movie. It was and the Brown Depths monster as himself. So Ernst finds out about this curse, and he also finds out that indeed people love this movie. But a lot of people only know about the movie because of the mystery surrounding it, the controversy surrounding it. Death has haunted this movie almost from the very beginning. And so that's what the story is about. It's just about a person being appreciated when he's gotten old and lonely. Then there's, of course, a nasty twist to that, where, you know, Ernst gets to find out that there is indeed a curse on this movie. And the story, it really gave me the opportunity to write about two things that I love. And one is about movie making. I love movie production and stories and how films get made and the intricacies of special effects and screenwriting. I wanted to be a filmmaker from a young age, and this story, I got to write about something that, you know, I was passionate about and have a little bit of experience with. But the other thing is I got to write about fan conventions. I've been to the Fangoria Weekend of Horrors conventions that they used to have, and I've been to many, many, many Comic-Cons. I've been to the San Diego Comic-Con 10 times, which is just amazing if you think about that. I mean, very sad, too, if you want to put that kind of point on it. But, you know, these are things that I love. I love fan conventions. And so I got to write about both of these things. Plus, I got to build a mythology around this Brown Depths movie. And I got to try and write a scary story, too. It was a pleasure to bring this story to you, to your ears or your eyes. And it's available out there. It's called The Newfound Fame. I kicked around several titles. Newfound Celebrity is one that I liked a little bit, but one title that I really liked was The Fame Monster, because Lady Gaga had an album called The Fame Monster, and I'm no fan of Lady Gaga at all. But I thought, ooh, you know, fame and monster, and ooh, neat, neat. But anyway, that is out there. You can purchase it. You can download it. You can listen to it. And I'll put links here in the show notes. But I thought that I would present to you a segment of the film, of the story here, just so you could hear, this is at the horror convention. There is a panel called The Brown Depths Remembered. And it's just Anton Moss, this guy that's hired Ernst to be on the panel, and Ernst. And he's talking about, you know, the costume and talking about the special effects, what it was like to work for this director. And, you know, he's doing questions and answers from the audience. And then somebody stands up and they ask about the curse. And I'm going to present that part to you right here. Just a couple minutes. It's pretty much the same stuff that you could get on Audible, the sample that is available there. I'll listen to it, and then I'll say a tiny bit more on the other side.
The next question came from a middle-aged guy with glasses and an official Halloween spooktacular t-shirt, as many people were wearing.
Hi, Mr. Hillerman. I just wondered what you thought of the curse, whether you believe in it or not.
Several people voiced their support for this question.
The curse?
Ernst asked. He remembered, vaguely, that the movie was about a monster that came alive whenever people came around and bothered it, if that was the curse they were talking about.
You know, the curse of the Brown Depths?
Ernst shook his head. The reaction from the crowd was hard to gauge. They either thought he was stupid, or were feeling cheated that he hadn't answered the question truthfully. Alonzo spoke up beside him.
You've never heard of the curse? I thought we talked about this.
Don't think so.
He addressed the crowd. You've got to remember, Mr. Hillerman doesn't have the internet. His place didn't even have electricity.
Well, that wasn't true. There were lights, a television Ernst seldom used, even flushing toilets.
Moss looked through his note cards.
Over the years, people have begun to speculate that, like other franchises, Superman, Poltergeist, there's a curse on the production of the Brown Depths.
Ernst leaned forward.
What does that mean, curse on the production? Because nobody went to see it.
Alonzo Moss paused. He licked his lips. The audience was restless, whispering amongst themselves. Ernst felt like he was missing something, a joke that was so old to them they didn't need to hear the punchline.
You see, there have been a series of accidents, incidents, related to the movie. The writer, director, Ian Bowman, well, he came out to Los Angeles after the movie was made, hoping to strike it big. They say he met with a couple of studios, based on the strength of his feature, and...
Moss licked his lips again. He was murdered. His arms and legs were all broken.
He was torn apart, the middle-aged guy at the microphone added. They thought it was an animal at first that did it.
Is that true?
He asked Moss. A nod.
So far as I know, the killer was never brought to justice.
Moss glanced down at his notes again.
Sonny Caldwell, the film's producer, disappeared while jogging, never resurfaced. This was in North Carolina. Also in North Carolina, Paige Schneider, the film's main actress, jumped from a hotel room window, leaving no note.
Oh, my,
Ernst heard himself say. That girl had been so lovely, both physically and personally. The middle-aged guy at the microphone went on, as though he had notes in front of him as well.
Brandon Ramirez, the actor who played Brad, OD'd on heroin in 1989. Shannon Irwin, who played Etika, disappeared after an audition. Never turned up.
Yes, in New York, Moss added. This and other tragic incidences have led many to, speculate that there was a curse on the production, but that could...
Lolly Fontaine, the middle-aged guy threw in, drove off the road in the hills in Raleigh, North Carolina. Her body was found 3 days later. The bugs had been...
Lolly Fontaine?
Ernst asked Moss. She was the cinematographer. She worked on a couple of documentaries, including...
She also played Margot, said the fan at the microphone.
Yes, thank you,
Moss said to the man, hoping he'd take the hint and leave the mic. He didn't, waiting for Ernst's opinion. Ernst swallowed.
This is the first I've heard of any of that. I wasn't really friends with any of them, the people who made the movie. After I worked on it, I went back to being a trash man. I haven't seen any of those guys since the night we all watched it at the theater. A bunch of sweet, enthusiastic kids making a movie. I wish I had better stories to tell. And I lived in that same town for 10 or so years after that, then retired and moved out to the boonies, where you found me.
He glanced at the crowd gathered to hear him talk.
I never had anything bad happen to me all the time I lived there.
So you don't think there's a curse? The middle-aged guy was still asking.
Well, I...
He seemed to take that as a cue to continue his stream of evidence.
Eric Teague, the makeup artist that designed your costume, he opened his wrists in a Kentucky trailer park in 1990. Left no suicide note, hadn't been depressed. It was his son's birthday the next day.
Next question, please,
said Moss, clearing his throat. The middle-aged fan frowned, but stepped away from the microphone and headed back to where he came from.
And then it goes on from there. I mean, it just I liked the litany of bad experiences, of mishaps, of accidents, of mysteries that surround this production. It was fun to think about and try and make scary. I don't know how scary that was, what you just heard, but later on, when Ernst starts to suspect that there's truth to this, hopefully the story does get scary. I don't know. One way to find out, and that is to buy it. But a minute ago I said I'm going to play a clip from the movie or something like that. The reason I said that was that I also had this other idea that instead of presenting all of the backstory that I had come up with as dialogue, which was my original intent, you know, somebody telling Ernst, well, like the scene you just heard where, okay, here is just a laundry list of bad things that have happened and rules about, you know, the curse of the brown depths and stuff. I thought, what if I included excerpts from the original screenplay of the Brown Depths movie? And, you know, I included those to just show little scenes from the movie that maybe you get referred to later at one of the at the panel. And I don't know if it works or not. But when it came time to do the audiobook version, yeah, okay, I read all those scene descriptions and lines. You know, I did different voices and stuff for the characters. But I thought what would be really cool is if I did this part in full cast and I got people to do the parts of the characters in the movie and act it instead of just, well, I mean, I act it, but you know what I'm saying. In fact, in the back of my mind, I thought, well, maybe I could put music under it and sound effects and make a lot more work for myself, really, is what I thought about. But I thought, well, that will make for a unique listening experience if you have voices. Just pretend that it's an excerpt from this movie. And I deliberately wrote a couple of lines that are dated or... I don't want to say not very well written, because you'd probably say that about the whole story if you thought these lines were not well written. But tried to have a little bit of fun with the fact that it was a movie in the 80s rather than something that I am writing in the 21st century. Anyhow, I hope that it's a good story and that it is scary and that the parts that are supposed to be funny are funny. In fact, I'm going to say one more awful thing that may come back to haunt me in the future, but there's a moment toward the very end of Newfound Fame where I think it's probably my favorite thing I've ever written. I know is that I really enjoyed writing this story. And there are different levels of enjoyment that I have in writing. And the worst is when something just is not coming and I'm forcing myself to write it. And more times than not, it'll just peter out and I end up abandoning that project. It's sad because there's some where I've done hours and hours and hours of work, or pages and pages and pages are written, and then it just peters out. It never reaches the end. And that's sad. But on the other end of the spectrum was something like this, where it was just a pleasure to write, fun to come up with. You know, there were a couple of challenges, but they were the kind of challenges where you just enjoy solving problems. And you're just like, huh, okay, how can I solve that? Oh, gosh, I don't know. But it's fun. They were like puzzles that I needed to solve or put together. It would be great if somebody read this story and said, you know, I can tell that you enjoyed writing this. And I enjoyed reading it. And, you know, I can't make that guarantee, but what was it that Big always says on the Doonstief? He says, if you enjoyed listening to it half as much as we enjoyed making it, well, we still enjoyed it twice as much as you. And that's it. Newfound Fame, written by Rish Outfield, 2016. Scoop it up if you have any interest at all. If you have no interest at all, well, I'll meet you in the next one.
Spock, you're half human. Don't you have any goddamn feelings about that?
That is the sound of somebody taking out the garbage, kids.
Okay, so it is months later. I had a lot more difficulty with the full cast parts than I thought that I would, and I guess I was also cowardly in delaying when I released it. I don't know. I would have thought that I was... No, sorry. You would have thought that I'd be over that by now, that I would have outgrown that, come up with excuses so as not to put something out. Phase. But, yeah, I struggled with getting people's lines. And then when I finally got all the lines, which took a long time, I put them all in and I realized that I had missed one. And it was important. To me, it was important. It was a line where I just thought, oh, gosh, this needs to be established. That was part of the reasoning for doing the movie within the story, was to set up the rules in a fun way. Fun for me, at least. And this was really important. And I'd missed that line. And it had taken so long to get the lines from this person that I was like, shoot, what am I going to do? I'm going to end up delaying it. And so what I ended up doing is I rewrote that scene so that it didn't need the line. The same information was conveyed. And then I re-recorded a portion of it. And there I was. I was done. Yay. And went on to Audible, or ACX is the user-friendly Audible portion. And I hit publish, and everything was great. And I edited the Outcast episode, just waiting to publish it. And a month went by. I thought, huh, well, usually it's within 2 or 3 days you get approval. Every once in a while, when it's been a large file or something like that, it's been a week or more. But invariably, if it's been that long, there's something wrong. They found something that they don't like, and I thought, oh, I'll bet it's this full cast stuff. I should have known that was going to come back to bite me. But they never said anything. And so I thought, well, maybe they accepted it, and I just never got an email that said that they had accepted it. I guess I should explain. They have employees, and I don't know if they're real employees or if they're machines that are anatomically correct. And, you know, they have bosoms, and they're programmed to obey your every command. But these employees are in charge of going through the files and making sure that the volume... So they go through the files and they check things such as, is there silence at the end of every chapter? Is there an appropriate amount of violence? Is there an appropriate amount of volume? You know, is it too loud? Is it too quiet? Did you save the files all in the same format, the same file quality? They have a bar and you have to save at that level. Is there background noise, that kind of thing? I don't imagine there's somebody. I mean, it could be that they have interns that work there, but I don't imagine the interns sit down and listen to people's audiobooks. I imagine they listen to something at random and or a machine checks everything. And if it flags something, then it gets kicked back to you and it's like, okay, here's what was wrong. You need to fix this. And I have had that happen a couple of times. It's usually volume. They're just like, hey, this needs to be louder. But yeah, it seems like there was one time when a file had like 6 seconds of silence at the end of it. And they're like, this is too much silence. The silence is deafening. And so I went on there. I couldn't find the file. They hadn't accepted it. And so today, just now, I went in and I went in there to make sure that I had hit publish, because there are a couple of steps that you have to take before they will accept your audio. And I had not put the closing credits on there. I had uploaded everything. I had uploaded the sample that you've already heard, and I hadn't put the credits on there, which I recorded months ago. And so, it was not their fault at all. It was my fault. I was a little disgusted about that, and still am. So I was taking out the garbage, and I thought I would record for a minute just to talk about it and give you a little bit more content in this episode. So, as of right now, the text file is available. People can buy it. But what I want people to buy is the audio. I don't know that I will ever do this kind of thing again, you know, the music and the voices. But it was an experiment. And for this project, I felt like going above and beyond, trying to make it special in that way. The audio will be available by the time this is released. Hopefully this can be my next episode, because it's just sat for 6 months. Maybe it's not been six. And somebody asked me the other day, why Salt Lake? And the thing is, I've gone to a convention there at the Salt Palace Convention Center. And so I knew what the layout was like. I had a friend that lives up there, and I asked her about the club, the one where he goes, and, oh, you haven't heard the book. This is coming out asking you to buy the book. Okay, well, spoiler warning, some of it takes place in Salt Lake City, Utah. No, but somebody asked me about why Salt Lake, and to me, the idea was funny of a horror convention in Utah. Because, Utah is super, super conservative. I mean, more so than, you've got the Bible Belt and all that stuff, but there's also the idea of good old boys down there and people that want to have a good time, even if, the bars are closed on Sundays. But Salt Lake does not have that reputation. They tend to be seen as humorless. They tend to be seen as super old-fashioned, like 100 years ago old-fashioned. And so that to me was funny. And I mentioned it to somebody that I was going to have it. I think it was Austin, the guy that did my cover art. And he thought that was funny. He said, but did you know that the World Horror Convention was held in Utah? And I said, the World Horror Convention? And he said, yeah. And he was right. It was like 2015. It was super recent. And, I guess every year that convention, it's like, one of those. It's like the World Science Fiction Convention, I guess. The World, you know, Romantic Fanfic with the Names Changed Convention is held in a different city every year. And yeah, it was in Utah super recently. And that to me seemed amusing. And I was like, I wonder how many people went to that convention. Anyway, when I heard that, when Austin told me that, I was just like, oh, well, that's fine then. I mean, it makes it a little bit less funny, but somebody out there might say, no, 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 you know what? The World Horror Con was held there in 2014 or something. And maybe it adds credibility to my silly story. I shouldn't have called it silly. I want you to buy it. But this episode has been a long time in coming. I'm glad that it's finally out there. And now we can move on to something else. Thank you if you bought it. Thank you if you support me on Patreon. When I recorded the rest of this episode, there was no Patreon fund. And now there is. And there are a handful of people that support me. And I love each and every one of them. Especially you, sir or ma'am. Anyhow, thank you. Next week will we be back with stuttering, apparently. We'll be back with something else. Good night.
Thank you for listening to another episode. I have been Rish. I have been, and ever shall be, your friend.
Live long and prosper.
The podcast that will never win a Parsec is produced under a creative... Oh, and now a word from our sponsor.
Hello, my name is Roderick Usher, and today I'd like to talk to you about a very special product. It's simply marvelous. From the makers of Almost Berry Mix, Pseudo Tasty Cocktail, an overly diluted elixir. But first, let me say a few words about myself. I come from a proud, noble family, one reaching back through the ages to the dawn of civilized society. But there is a curse on the House of Usher, in that as we get older, our senses sharpen, our hearing, sight, touch, smell, and taste begin to increase, to the point where we must recuse ourselves to private chambers, away from the light, from the pounding din of the world, from the stench of humanity, until we rot in there, becoming like trapped animals, or succumbing to insanity. 'Tis a morbid acuteness of the senses, affecting even what little I can bear to eat or drink. Yes, not the most pleasant birthright, to be sure. But then I discovered Sobe Life Water, a wondrous product that I feel the Creator himself may have designed for me in mind. No more will I be impelled to dine on bread crusts, pencil shavings, and basement seepage. Sobe Life Water is so slight, so subtle, that my palate can actually stomach it. Imagine, if you will, the taste of sitting water, only blander. Think of a goblet in which wine or cider once sat, and now one has filled with water. Just the merest hint of flavor, the weakest residue of tang, the saddest ghost of what it used to hold. Available in a variety of near flavors, orange, grape, lemon, peach, grapefruit, guava, sponge, passion fruit, coconut, oyster, lime, cabbage, banana, beet, carp, and now Bing Cherry Vanilla. Though you may not be of the House of Usher, and bear the unholy burden that comes with it. You can have the benefit of soapy life water yourself. I swear on my mad sister Madeline, it's almost like drinking nothing at all.
The Rish Outcast is still produced under a Creative Commons Attribution No Derivatives license. It doesn't look like it's going away anytime soon. And remember, there's a Patreon page out there if you'd like to throw a dollar or two my way. I must be dreaming.
Instead, he was operating the ship's controls and running down occasionally to wind the springs on the captain. To wind the springs on the capstan treadmill, a task ordinarily consigned to slaves. With such heavy use, the springs needed to be wound. The springs needed to be wound frequently. One more time. With such heavy use, the springs needed to be wound frequently.
Please, do not freeze, computer, please.
He was one of Arkov's cubs from Nadine's final litter, one who took after his father in temperament, if not in size. A baby cousin to Carmine, often tagging along behind him and Teek and Myla.
But you're a boy.
Sonny and Ptolemy shifted in their sleep.
But you're a boy.
Keisha thought he understood then.
Carmine is his favorite.
Damn it. But you're a boy.
Well, I am pleased to have been no stupider. Than the average cub.
But you're a boy.
I am pleased to have been no stupider than the... Well, I am pleased to have been no stupider than the average cub.
But you're a boy.
Keisha had already started to hum. He was singing an old Telshi lullaby, a song for peace and comfort, not unlike the one he'd sung to Ptolemy when they'd met.
I'll be a love suicide, and I'll be better when I'm older. I'll be the greatest time of your life.